Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, we begin a fine critique of 21st Century Capitalism American Style. It's by Joseph Stiglitz, and it's well worth a listen. I hope you'll stay tuned. The other day, I stumbled across a talk from 2012 by economist Joseph Stiglitz. Much to my surprise, I liked it a lot. Also to my surprise, I wanted to share it on New World Notes. Stiglitz is a well-known, highly respected, often influential member of the establishment. To be sure, he's on the liberal side of the establishment. But establishment he is. How establishment is he? How about the holder of an endowed professorship at Columbia University? How about former chairman of the President's Council on Economic Advisers? How about former chief economist of the World Bank? In fact, Stiglitz is a critic of capitalism as capitalism is actually practiced in the United States. In this talk, he criticizes our economic system of monopoly, rule by Wall Street, globalization, and inequality. And in listening to his very articulate criticism, I kept hearing the voices of the more radical speakers that have been on our show over the past few months. Listening to Stiglitz, I kept thinking, hey, Michael Parenti said that on the show just a couple of weeks ago. Or, hey, that reminds me of Noam Chomsky. Or, gadzooks, Richard Wolff would have said the same thing. Stiglitz stops short of these progressive leftists in addressing the question, what to do? Apparently, his solutions are reforms to capitalism and government. Greater power to corporate stockholders, for example. I say these are presumably his solutions because Stiglitz doesn't want to talk about the 22 solutions he has proposed. They're in his 2012 book, if you want to see them. In fact, in this talk, Stiglitz says he doesn't have any great confidence that his 22 solutions will actually work. I give him a lot of credit for realizing that practical reforms will make things a little better, but probably won't fix the problem. But he's not going to come out with the conclusion, we need to scrap corporate capitalism. But though Stiglitz doesn't have an answer, he has an excellent analysis of the problem. The 2012 book I mentioned is The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future. And he gave this talk in 2012 in Washington, D.C. on his book tour. The words we'll hear today are 3.5 years old. But nothing in the stagnant U.S. economy has changed since Obama's re-election, and not a word of the talk needs to be changed. Well, I cut out a bunch of ums and stumbles, but that's all that was needed. We'll hear the talk in two parts, this week and next. Speaking on how inequality in today's society endangers our future, here is Joseph Stiglitz.
This book grew out of an article I wrote in Vanity Fair. The title of that article summarizes a lot of about what I'm going to say. The title of that article was Of the 1%, by the 1%, and for the 1%. And it describes something of our polity and our economy. What I want to do this evening is to try to describe the magnitude of the inequality in the United States, which I think most people haven't fully grasped. The causes of this inequality, the consequences, and I'm going to argue that it's actually very bad for our economy, but also very bad for our democracy. I'll talk a little bit about the way it manifests itself in almost every aspect of public decision, from budgets to macroeconomic policy, And then finally, I'll have a few words to say about what can be done about it, because I'm going to argue it's not inevitable. It's a consequence of the policies that we've adopted, and to try to say what could be done. One of the presidential candidates suggested that you shouldn't talk about these things in public. He also said it's all about the politics of envy. And I'm going to try to argue it's not about the politics of envy. It's really a debate about the justification and consequences of the level of inequality that inequality has reached in America today. One aspect is to say that most Americans don't realize is that America today has more inequality than any of the other advanced industrial countries. And that itself says something, because we like to think of inequality as having something to do with market forces. But market forces are there all over the world. What we do with our polity, what we do in government affects those how the market forces operate. And the way that has happened in the United States has resulted in our having more inequality than any other society. And that should be a cause of reflection. Not only have we attained this high level of inequality, it's been growing. And it's been growing actually very rapidly. It used to be said that, you know, watching inequality grow was like watching grass grow. It's very hard to see it happen. But in fact, what's been happening in the United States has been extraordinarily rapid. Since 1980, the share of the national income that goes to the top 1% has doubled, from 10% to 20%. That means the upper 1% gets $1 out of $5. That's in terms of income, but in terms of wealth, the inequality is even greater. The top 1% gets about 40% of all the wealth. However you slice it, inequality is growing. At the very, very top, the top 0.1%, their share of GDP has tripled since 1980. And if you look at what's happened more recently, say in 2010, in the recovery from the Great Recession, not a full recovery, they say not a real recovery, but what happened in that year, the top 1% got 93% of the growth of our economy. But even more disturbing in some ways is what's been happening to opportunity. Ryan, the head of the budget committee, said, oh, we're not interested in inequality outcomes. What we're interested in is opportunity. But unfortunately, that's not any better. The United States is the country with the least equality of opportunity of any of the advanced industrial countries for which there's data. And what does that mean? It means that the life chances of somebody born at the bottom are much less than those somebody born in the middle and the top, and that there's a higher correlation, a higher dependence of a child's prospects on the education and income of his parents than in any of the other advanced industrial countries. That should be very disturbing, because we think of ourselves as a land of opportunity, and we all know examples of people who've made it from the bottom to the top, from the middle to the top. We all know examples of immigrants from poor backgrounds who've made it to the top. But when economists talk about opportunity, we don't mean these examples of these exceptions. What we mean is what happens on average? What are the life chances? And in that dimension, America is performing more poorly than any of the other advanced industrial countries. What this bodes for the future of inequality in the United States, because if there is less equality of opportunity, it's more likely that in the future we will have even more inequality in a vicious circle that I'll come back to later. As I said, this level of inequality is not inevitable. Other countries have less inequality. We had less inequality in our past. Even the increase in inequality is not inevitable. The United States, say a decade or two ago, had even then the highest level of inequality, but our inequality has been increasing rapidly while others have managed to tame the increase of inequality, and a few countries have actually reversed it and brought down the degree of inequality. One example of that, of such a country, is Brazil. And one way of looking at what happened in Brazil, one interpretation, is that they looked over the precipice. They saw where they were going, the kind of divides in their society, people living in gated homes, a kind of political, social, economic turmoil, and they said, we can't go there. And there developed a cohesion of even the 1% saw that it was not in their interest for the continuation of their society to go in the direction that it was going. And then a president on the right, President Cardoza, not very far right, by American standards, probably on the left, President Cardoza said it was important for everybody to get an education, and he really pushed this. And then, of course, you all know about President Lula saying no child should go hungry. No child should go without vaccinations, and succeeded in actually doing a lot about the poverty in that country, so much so that it's already reflected in the data. You see the decline in inequality in a relatively short period of time. Now, those who defend this kind of inequality, and there are, as you know, many, although increasingly few, those who defend this level of inequality say, as I say, it's the politics of envy. Everybody really benefits. And that's an idea called trickle-down economics. You throw enough money at the top, and somehow it trickles down, and eventually everybody benefits. I wish it were true, because if it were true, given the level of inequality we would have, everybody would be actually in pretty good shape. But if you look at the data, right now, most Americans, and let me repeat, most Americans are worse off than they were a decade and a half ago. In other words, incomes adjusted for inflation at the median, half above, half below, are lower than they were in 1997. And that's really striking. So the American economy has not been working for most Americans. It's been working very well for those at the upper 1% or 10%, but not for the majority of Americans. Another statistic that I find even more troubling is when you parse it out more finely, what you see is the extent to which some groups in our society have been doing particularly poorly. One group are males. That has a large fraction of our population, obviously. Male workers, a full-time male worker in the United States, his income, adjusted for inflation, median, people in the middle, is lower than it was in 1968, almost a half century ago. And if you want to understand some of the frustration, some of the alienation, it has a lot to do with people finally beginning to figure out that the American dream is not true. So the idea that you shouldn't complain because while the bottom may be getting and the middle may be getting a smaller share, the pie is getting bigger, and therefore the size of the slice they're getting is bigger, that's just wrong. In fact, if you look historically, in the period, in the decades immediately after World War II, our economy grew much faster than it did in the period after 1980. And the period after World War II was a period in which we grew together. The people at the bottom, every group grew, but the people at the bottom grew more rapidly as contrasted to the period after 1980, where the bottom and the middle have not done very well, but the people at the top have done very well. And this relationship between inequality and growth is not an accident. And I'm going to try to come to that later, that I believe that this inequality actually has been harming our economy. It's also the case that our views of inequality would be different if those at the very top receive their income because of the greater contribution that they made. The idea that those at the top receive their high income, a justification, has been part of economic theory for a very long time. Those of you who studied standard economics may remember the theory called marginal productivity theory. People's pay is related to their contribution. Well, that idea was totally undermined, in my judgment, by what happened in the Great Recession. You may remember that those bankers who brought the world's economy to the brink of ruin, who brought their own firm to the brink of ruin, so that their contribution, either to their firm or to our society, was unambiguously negative, walked off with very large bonuses. So how could you say that their pay was a result of their marginal productivity? I sometimes joke that sometimes, you know, you make a sign error, and so they thought it was negatively correlated rather than positively correlated. But that's not what the theory really is supposed to say. In fact, some firms were so embarrassed by this lack of congruence between performance and pay that they decided to change the name from performance pay to retention bonus. But, of course, it raises the same question. Why do you want to retain somebody who brought you to the brink of ruin? So that, I think, is one of the reasons that there's such discontent. If you look at the people who've made the most important contributions to our societies, Turing, who did the mathematics behind the computer, the people who discovered the transistor, the laser, you can go down all the major innovations, DNA, that have transformed our society. None of them are in the top wealthiest people in our country or in the world. The people who wind up there have done something different. I'm going to come to that in a minute. I do want to say before coming to that there are many dimensions to America's inequality. It's not only that there's too much money at the top, but there's also been a hollowing out of the middle class. Their income, I mentioned, is lower, but it's also the fraction of the population that are in a range of that middle has been getting smaller, and the country is becoming more polarized. And a consequence of that is that there are a significantly larger fraction of the population that are in poverty today. One example of that brought home when I was in India not long ago, and on the front page, they had a big article about how one out of seven Americans was on food stamps. And one out of seven Americans, even though they were on food stamps, face food insecurity. That means they go to bed at least once a month hungry, not because they're on a diet, but because they can't afford food. And, of course, the context, you know, the Indians were finding this amazing. America is supposed to be this rich country, and yet here, even in America, there are so many people that can't afford food and remain hungry. Well, the recession has made all these problems worse, particularly in the area of wealth. It's had a devastating effect because Americans in the bottom and middle put most of their wealth in their homes. And when the house prices went down by 30%, in some places by 50%, they lost everything. And so that leads to the kinds of statistics such that the six members of the Walton family have a wealth that's equal to the bottom 30% of America. And that's a testimony to how rich the rich is, but it's also testimony to how poor the bottom is. And when you look at inequality, it manifests itself in every other dimension, in health, for instance, in life expectancy. If you happen to be poor, your life expectancy is markedly lower, especially in America, because we don't have any commitment to providing health care for everyone. So let me now spend a few minutes, and I'm running out of time, explaining the sources of this inequality. And each part of the inequality, the increase in the top, the hollowing out in the middle, the increase in poverty, has their own explanations. And I'm going to spend most of my time, a limited time, talking about the top. One of the arguments in the book is that a lot of the income at the top is related to rank seeking. Those who are not economists, let me explain what ranks are. Ranks are the income you get not from working, not from effort, but from your ownership. Say it originated from landowners, they got rents. But now economists have generalized that. And the basic idea is a very simple one. The question is, are you making the pie bigger, that's creating wealth, or are you trying to get a bigger share of a given pie? And in the fight to get a bigger share of the given pie, you actually may make the pie smaller. And we're used to talking about the problem of rent seeking in oil, oil countries and Russia. We think we describe these countries as rent seeking economies. But what most Americans don't realize is we've become, to a large extent, a rent seeking economy. So examples of rents that diminish the size of the pie are like monopoly. Monopoly, you get your profits by restraining output, but not by producing more, but by constricting output. And if you look at the people at the top, they include some monopolists. And not only my judgment of monopoly, it's what American courts have judged as monopoly. You can figure out what I'm talking about. Another kind of rank-seeking, example of rank-seeking, occurs as a result of our deficiencies in corporate governance. The CEOs of many of the corporations have been very successful in getting for themselves a larger share of the corporate pie. And this has increased enormously in the last 30 years. Much worse in the United States than in any other country. You cannot relate their pay to any higher level of productivity of American corporations, as the example I gave in the financial sector illustrates. If you had somebody that worked for you, you would say you have the right to determine what their pay is. I mean, it's almost obvious. The managers of companies are supposed to work for the shareholders. But the managers fought tooth and nail to stop a simple provision that would say shareholders should have say in pay. Other countries like Australia have such legislation. But the CEOs in America said it would be the end of capitalism because they would be held accountable. And that's an example of rank-seeking, getting a larger share of the pie. Market forces obviously do play a role in affecting the level of inequality that we have, but market forces don't exist in a vacuum, and the laws and regulations that we pass shape those market forces. And let me just give you two examples that illustrate that. Take our bankruptcy law. Our bankruptcy law in the United States gives first priority to derivatives. Those risky securities that brought down AIG and required a bailout of $150 billion. We say those are the most important things in our society, more important than paying wages or anything else, derivatives. And of course, the consequence of that is that resources move into derivatives, making our economy more unstable. At the other extreme, in the bankruptcy law, we say that student debt cannot be discharged even in bankruptcy, even if the school does not deliver on the education they promised. You know, in most areas, you say satisfaction guaranteed and your money back. But in this sphere, as those for-profit schools, many of them owned by Wall Street, have tried to exploit the least educated, sophisticated students, what they've said is you won't get your money back no matter what we give you, and your student loan will be an albatross around your neck for the rest of your life. In effect, what I argue in the book, we've reintroduced in the United States a kind of indentured servitude, partial indentured servitude. Another example that should be deeply disturbing is the way the financial sector has been very successful in predatory lending and abusive credit card practice, a whole set of things of that kind, which effectively move money from the bottom to the top. So that helps explain the two extremes, why there's so much money at the top and why there's so little money at the bottom. And our legal framework gave them the scope to do that. So that's another set of explanations for the unusual level of inequality in the United States. The final set of explanations has to do with government munificence. Those at the top use their political influence to get more money out of the government. And it takes many forms. When I was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, one of the tasks that I was given was to identify corporate welfare and try to do something about it. It's not so easy to identify the corporate welfare because an awful lot of it is buried in the tax code, not easy to find. But it was there and it was very, very large. But unfortunately, while we could identify it after a lot of work, we couldn't do anything about it. In fact, in the subsequent years, it grew enormously. The largest act of corporate welfare, of course, was the bailout of the banks in the trillions of dollars. But in addition to this, there are a whole set of other open and largely hidden subsidies. An example of hidden subsidies is when the government pays more than market prices for what it buys. An example was in Medicare Part D, the drug benefit of Medicare. Very important program, but there was one sentence, and it shows you how you can, you know, one sentence can make a big difference. One sentence that said the government, the largest purchaser of drugs, could not bargain with the drug companies. And the estimated cost of that one sentence is $500 billion over 10 years. Again, just a gift to the top. The other way, of course, is to sell public assets at below market prices. Again, a kind of giveaway. When we sell minerals, we ask them to pay only a nominal amount, not anything related to the fair market value. So again, it's a giveaway that leads to more inequality. Well, these and the things I've described have contributed to making the U.S. the country with the most unequal before tax and transfer distribution of income. But what's also remarkable about the United States is that we do less to correct the inequality of market income. That is to say, we do less through progressive taxation and transfers to make our society more equal, even given the high level of inequality that we have. And things, again, have gotten worse. Most of you probably know about the most egregious example of that, and that is that the average tax rate of the top 1% is around 15%, much less than those who earn a much lower income. And we all know at least one person who falls exactly in that category, not paying his fair share of taxes. The reason for this, of course, is that we have special provisions in the tax code for the taxation of capital gains. It's taxed at a much lower income than people who work for a living. But you think about, what is that doing? What that says is, if you make your money by speculating, buying CDSs, trying to bring down the Greek economy, cause turmoil in the world, you're going to be taxed at 15%. If you work hard and try to make an innovation and are successful, you'll be taxed at 35%. You can say, how does this reflect either our values or a system of economic efficiency? What it does reflect, of course, is politics.
Here we must pause. We've heard the first part of a talk by economist Joseph Stiglitz, how inequality in today's society endangers our future. We'll have the rest of this fine talk next week. You can find this program and nearly all of our others on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Also advising illegitimi non carborundum, an injury to one is an injury to all. Keep the aspidistra flying, and please come back again next week. Ciao.